You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face, incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Now, when I say lift and I say separate, I mean that mostly we do really good movies, but occasionally we'll do one that may be known for other reasons. That is not the case today. However, David and I are old friends. We've been talking movies since we were kids. Now we do it weekly for you guys. And we come into this blind. We pick a movie from over the last century of horror and science fiction, and we talk about it. And those of you that have joined us before know all this. I just wanted to explain that for those of you that are new to us. Mm-hmm. And we would like to welcome you. I am here with my good friend and co-host, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I am doing well. Are good, at least. It's been an interesting week of a bunch of stuff that I'm like halfway through, so I'm not finished with some. So I don't want to mention it for my genre week. You know, normally we start this with a genre topic. What have you been doing, you know, related? So for me, that's science fiction. Sometimes I pop over to horror and sometimes you pop over to science fiction. But
very funny that you say that.
but I did finally finish one that I've talked about twice before. But I'm going to use it as my genre topic because I've got a new kind of bent on it sort of thing after reading some other reviews and talking to some other people or getting their opinions sort of thing, which is the new Black Mirror. Have you finished the new Black Mirror?
I don't usually watch that show, but you told me it has werewolves in it now, so I'm interested.
And that's exactly what I wanted to mention. So for those of you who are, you know, longtime listener watchers of us, I've mentioned Black Mirror several times through the years because
almost
always,
as much as The Expanse.
I've always thought it's a very informative, very intelligent, very kind of unique anthology science fiction series, which there aren't a lot of those out there. And Charlie Brooker is the big guy behind it. Those of you who know Black Mirror know that if you're trying to get someone started on it, the very first thing you say is don't ever watch the first episode. Just start with the second episode of season one and go from there. Because the first episode is like intentionally offensive and it turns a lot of people off. So it's much better to start on that second episode and go through and maybe eventually you'll come back to the pilot original episode. And it's gone through different owners. It went from BBC to Netflix. And Netflix, you know, Americanized a lot of it when it came to America sort of thing. Let's put Miley Cyrus in an episode, you know, that kind of thing. This season, season six, is the shortest season they've ever done. There's only five episodes. So it used to be they would do, you know, when it was at the BBC, they did their traditional, we're only doing three. And
that's not really traditional. BBC usually does like six, but three is short to me.
Well, it depends on the length of them and stuff. Like, look at Sherlock. All, you know, the first like three seasons of Sherlock were only three episodes, but they were 90-minute episodes. So it's kind of like that. These vary in length depending on the story and what he's telling and everything else, yada, yada. Anyway, but then when it became a Netflix thing, suddenly it went to six episodes. And then it went to, I think it stayed six until this past season. So this past season went down to five. And I have to say, I don't like any of them. going back and rewatching them again, I'm not a fan of this season. And it's because I think he's lost track of what it is. It's kind of like my new soapbox for this year is series that have been either rebooted or redone or rechanged. And they're different than the original. That can be done. That's great and fine. But if you don't keep the tenets of the original or the same kind of thought process or thematics that you want.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, it's a sci-fi show. Don't do horror stuff.
Right. Or if you're doing horror, which, you know, several Black Mirrors have been very scary and right. very, very intimidating and very depressing and very dreadful kind of thing. So you can do all of the power emotions, just keep the sci-fi as your basic tenet underneath it. There are three entire episodes out of these five, three episodes that have nothing to do with technology at all.
So, right. And that show is not only sci-fi, but it used to deal with just pretty much technology, didn't it?
Correct. The basic tenet, in my opinion, of Black Mirror is technology in the wrong hands, or technology bad, or how can technology go wrong?
Go wrong. Yeah. Gotcha.
That's the thematic that they use. And that could be anything from social media to our obsession with television to, you know, whatever.
Werewolves.
And the first episode in this one involves technology just because it's that whole streaming service thing and getting everything to stream as quickly as possible. And the media doesn't care if it's real or not, even if it's CGI generated, just get it out there because the public needs more stuff. So this woman finds that her life is being turned into a television series that's on every night. So that is kind of terrifying, and that gives into that whole social, and that's technology, and that's great. There's one other one that is about two astronauts, and the technology is that in order for them to keep kind of mentally sound, they have robots of themselves, replicas of themselves on Earth, and they can periodically during the week get into those bodies and go back and feel like they're on Earth, even though they're 3 years into a 6 year space mission. Kind of thing. Okay, okay, cool. Technology. Those two work. The other three are all horror-based, for one thing, and there's no technology in them. And my soapbox for today is that I rewatched a couple of them. I talked, you know, I read, talked to some friends, did some stuff, everything else. And it's kind of like Brooker, the creator, writer, the big dog behind this, is kind of changing his series. He's saying, no, now I'm going to explore fantasy and I'm going to explore horror and I'm going to explore that side of it. But he's not supporting it with the basic tenet of the series, which was technology. You know, if you had there's one episode that has werewolves in it. Well, if they were somehow technologically linked werewolves, oh, they've got a chip in my head and it turns me into my primal self and I turn into a werewolf. That's a werewolf story that could be told science fiction wise, but this one isn't. This one is
or
just
Wolves of the Cala.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, that's what I did in my genre week, and it was frustrating. And next week, I'm going to do something fun.
Well, I know it's frustrating. Excuse me, because I think it's the third time you've talked about it.
Yeah, I want it to be so good because I love the series. You know, and like you said, yeah, it's probably my other most talked about topic other than The Expanse lately. So
right
there you go.
Right.
However, The Expanse done good. Yes. So there you go.
Well, you've been reading the books. The books are always better.
Yes. Yeah. And I have to correct myself on an earlier podcast. I said there's seven novels. They're not. They're nine. I finished them all because they added the last trilogy. I thought the seventh book was the end of the series, but it was just the beginning of the third trilogy. Sort of.
Okay.
Thing. So yeah. And they're great.
Interesting.
They are excellent. What did you do in your genre week?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned sometimes I dive over into your genre because I haven't done it that much lately. And this time I did, although I would classify this as a sci-fi horror movie. I went back and revisited the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956.
56,
This one, I love this movie. I love Kevin McCarthy, especially in it. It's directed by Don Siegel. I did a little research on him. Apparently, he was a bud of Clint Eastwood's and went on to direct things like Dirty Harry and Escape from Alcatraz. I didn't know that. I assumed that maybe this was directed by Jack Arnold, you know, or somebody from the 50s. Because we've kind of had 50s on the brain for a while.
Yeah.
It was written by Daniel Mainwaring, but it's based, of course, on the classic story by Jack Finney called The Body Snatchers. Now, they couldn't call the movie The Body Snatchers. Do you know why?
No.
Because 11 years prior, Universal, I believe, did a movie called The Body Snatcher, directed by Robert Wise, produced by Val Lewton, starring Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, based on the Robert Louis Stevenson story, The Body Snatcher.
Mm.
Which is something, obviously, we should cover because listen to that pedigree.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they eventually came up with the title Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which I think is a lot more snazzy and fits the movie perfectly.
Oh, much.
Yeah.
The paranoia that's in that movie is great. So.
Yes. Lots of subtle subtext of McCarthyism in this movie for you out there. Well, I'm not going to go into details because this is just a short part of our podcast. But once we do this, and we will do this, I guarantee you we'll do a show on this. As a matter of fact, I think we should do a double feature because I like the 78 version just as good as I like this version pretty much.
I do too. Actually, the Donald Sutherland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's got Leonard Nimoy in it. Mm-hmm. This one, however, stars Kevin McCarthy, Dana Winter, King Donovan, and Carolyn Jones. Carolyn Jones is the only other person I recognize in this movie because, of course, she played Morticia Adams on the original Adams Family.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin McCarthy, I can't say enough about him in this movie. And I read a little history that he was jealous of his friend's career because he was doing big movies and he and McCarthy was doing B movies, science fiction B movies. And that friend was Montgomery Clift, who was currently making Raintree County with Elizabeth Taylor at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
However, no one remembers Raintree County, and everyone remembers Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So I think it's kind of funny that Kevin kind of won in the end, as far as that's concerned. The synopsis is in Santa Mira, California. Dr. Miles Bennell is baffled when all his patients come to him with the same complaint that their loved ones seem to have been replaced by emotionless imposters. Despite dismissive denials, Dr. Bennell, his former girlfriend Becky, and another couple soon discover the patient's suspicions are true. An alien species of human duplicates are being grown from plant-like pods and taking over the town. Such a cool premise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if you had to say, you know, list the top, you know, 15 movies of the 20th century, science fiction, Invasion of the Body Snatchers would be there. And we should definitely do it just because of its influence.
I agree.
I think we mentioned it when we were even talking about I Married a Monster from Outer Space.
Yeah,
because it has such, you know, taking over the town with the pod people kind of feel. Yeah.
Yeah. And we talked about it briefly in our last top five of the 1950s. It was top five of the 1950s. But we couldn't talk about it much because there's so much science fiction in the 1950s.
Yeah.
However, I do want to say that this scores 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think that's a solid 98%.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So that's what I did. I tiptoed. I stuck my toe in the water of sci-fi.
Well, we definitely are ticking the whole foot in sci-fi this week because this is a unique science fiction concept done in a very unique way. When I was thinking about the fact I have to do a synopsis of this particular film, I was going, okay, you can either do the 7-word synopsis, which basically is just a bare bones covers the plot, or you could try to tell the synopsis, but it's very confusing because the movie is confusing. The book is confusing. We're doing... And you have to call it this. We are doing Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Came out in 1972. It was directed by George Roihill, who was a big director at the time. Written, of course, by Kurt Vonnegut and Stephen Geller. Stars Michael Sacks, Ron Liebman, Eugene Roche, several others that we'll get into when we get into casting. The easiest way to synopsize this movie, like I said, is the seven-word one of Billy Pilgrim has become unstuck in time. And that's what you go to reviews of this of this movie or the book, or you go to YouTube reviews about it, and that's how they always start. Billy Pilgrim has become unstuck in time, which is a huge sci-fi concept and works very well. There's a lot more to it, movie-wise and novel-wise, than that. Basically, you have a guy who is living in essentially three different times. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I will admit right now, I have never read this book. I've never read this novel.
That's awful.
Yeah, I know. It's awful. And that's kind of my literary deficit. I have the only Vonnegut I have ever read was Breakfast of Champions.
Which is crazy, but yeah.
Yeah. And I really should read more. Maybe I can add that to my read/listen.
You will after we do this podcast.
Okay. there's a – we'll talk about Vonnegut when we get to Vonnegut here in a second.
Sure.
But basically, Pilgrim is living out of time. If we want to talk about the movie
– sorry, let me interrupt you. You were on it earlier when you said there's basically three periods of his life that are covered in the movie. I mean, they may do a side jump here or there, but it's predominantly his war life, his domestic life, and his sci-fi part. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. He was a survivor of the bombing of Dresden as a prisoner of war in World War II. He goes on to become an optometrist with a domestic life, basically kind of the feel of the 50s sort of feel to it. And he is also a captive in, I guess, an intergalactic zoo sort of thing on the planet.
Yes.
Tralfamador.
Tralfamador.
And... the movie and the novel both go back and forth in those periods. And as far as the movie goes, there's no precept for why. In other words, there's no, oh, it's happening again. Here I go. I'm in the other time frame. By the end of the movie, the concept is that Billy experiences all three at the same time. So, it's a non-linear opinion of time. So Billy in World War II knows he probably won't die in World War II because he will go to Tralfamador and near the end of his life sort of thing. He knows he will be married. He knows his wife will die. You know, all of these things he knows all at the same time. As a matter of fact, he knows his own death and has always known his own death and even mentions it to his children that he knows when he's going to die and how he's going to die. So, concept, really sci-fi, really cool, really different. I guess I'll throw to you and say, because this is only the second time I've ever seen this movie. I saw it once in the 80s, and so I saw it this week for the podcast. And so, how did you come about this movie or the novel?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you saw it with me. I think we both watched it on videotape because I had a copy of it on videotape.
Yep. I'm pretty sure we did.
And I have not watched it since then either. But I do remember liking it, and I'm a huge Vonnegut fan. As a matter of fact, of any science fiction writer, I've probably read him more than anyone.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I adore him, and I mean, not just for sci-fi and writing, but because he was a humanist and just I don't know. He's just one of those people you would want to know. I'm sure he was probably a dick at times, because of things he went through, but he believed in the human race and the goodness of the human race. And that's why things like this puzzled him so much that he had to write novels about them.
Yeah, I don't think you can be a student or even appreciate literature without including Kurt Vonnegut.
No. As a matter of fact, I was a big Truman Capote fan, and there are a group of American writers. You know how I always group American writers by territories, like the Southern writers or the ones out on the West Coast? Well, yeah. He was up in Martha's Vineyard with Truman Capote, William Styron, Kurt Vonnegut, and I can't remember, maybe John Knowles. I can't remember. Anyway, those three for sure all lived near each other because Vonnegut used to tell stories about how Truman would come over to his house looking for booze. it's really funny. But anyway, and then I met William Styron, and that was fascinating to me because he did a signing for us at one of my stores, and he would, you know, I was like, you know, I love Truman Capote and I love Kurt Vonnegut. And he's like, you know, they live near me, right? I'm like, yes, I do know that. Anyway, I won't go off on Kurt Vonnegut. Back to the movie. I had forgotten how good this movie is. And I think it's a testament, especially to George Roy Hill, because George Roy Hill just directed phenomenally beautiful, good movies in the 70s and even into the 80s. Yeah. Classic movies like The Sting, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The World According to Garp. One of my only sports movies that I like, which is called Slapshot, which mm-hmm. is another Paul Newman movie, a hockey movie. And, of course, this one.
Great Waldo Pepper.
Right, mm-hmm. right, which is another Robert Redford movie.
Yep.
So coming back to it, I was pleasantly surprised. Now, if we're going to compare it to the book is far more resonant than the movie. The movie plays up the comedy a little more, not necessarily the sci-fi more, but he does have moments of brilliance in this movie where it hits you like a gut punch like the book does, but not as many. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, I mean, we can give spoilers. We're not, you know, the movies came out in 72. So, right. I mean, but I agree with you. I was going to say the exact same thing. Even if this movie had an even more confusing plot or not the best acting that it ever had, it had George Roy Hill, who right. is a phenomenal director. Mm-hmm. I did take issue with his interpretation of Tralfamador. Because I didn't like the lighting in that scene. I thought the lighting looked really studio
The whole special effect of the cage on the planet doesn't really look realistic.
Yeah, that's kind of a conceit of the time. Mm-hmm. They didn't put a lot of money in that, even though you can't say that because, hey, 3 years before was 2001, which revolutionized special effects. But true. George Roy Hill was not a science fiction director. He was a humanist director. And I think that's why he's a great choice for Vonnegut mm-hmm. and for the story, just not for some of the effects and mostly the Tralfamador. I love the way he shoots all the 50s stuff. Looks very like he's got a look that he wants for that entire period. And it works. The look for World War II has a look to it, has a color palette, has lighting, has, you know, works. Tralfamador does too, and it's different and distinct. I just didn't like it. It's just me personally. I thought it was overlit. I thought it looked like a studio. I started to kind of justify it saying, oh, yeah, he's doing that because they're in a zoo and they have to be well lit for everybody to see.
Right. I want the night canopy, please. Yeah.
I'd like the night canopy, please.
However, it could also, I may be stepping off a bridge here, but it could be that he was trying to make it look unrealistic because some people like to interpret this as him not really being kidnapped by aliens and being insane with like post-traumatic stress disorder and that maybe that part of it isn't real.
See, I read that in a couple of reviews. I never got that at all from the movie.
Well, both you shouldn't because I don't think it's the case.
I never got even a hint of the fact that, other than the fact that his, you know, it starts with his two children trying to find him or come in and wake him or talk to him that morning. Mm-hmm. But also And other than their kind of doubt in, I don't think dad can take care of himself kind of thing because he's spouting some weird kind of nonsense. Other than that, I never got, you know, PTSD. Oh, he's imagining this. Oh, this isn't happening. I bought the conceit that Billy Pilgrim was living out of time.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I did want to say before we jump off of it that
sure.
One of the things that Roy Hill did was he used an incredible cinematographer to create all that. So Miloslav, I think I'm saying it right, Audresic.
I didn't write it down. Is that the guy that does all of his movies, though, because they're so pretty?
He did a lot of his and a lot of ones that everyone remember, like Amadeus, Hair.
Okay. Oh, okay. So,
a really great cinematographer, especially at that time period. And I think it works really well for this movie. Scenes? You want to do scenes for this?
Well, we can do scenes. I was going to talk a little bit about the book before we got into it.
Yeah.
I clipped some of these out just because I wanted to put it into context. Slaughterhouse-Five has been called an example of unmatched moral clarity and one of the most enduring anti-war novels of all time. It was Vonnegut's first novel to become a bestseller. It stayed on the list for 16 weeks at number 4, and then in 1970 was nominated for Best Novel with a Nebula and a Hugo Award. It lost to something called The Left Hand of Darkness. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Ursula Le Guin.
Oh, Ursula K. Le Guin?
Yeah. Yes.
Novelist. She mostly did fantasy science fiction, though. Kind of John Carter on Mars sort of stories.
Yeah. Well, and Vonnegut's known for writing humorous science fiction. And since its release, it's been widely regarded as, like I said, a classic anti-war novel and has appeared in Time magazine's list of the 100 best English language novels written since 1923.
Well, okay, then.
The first sentence, and by the way, the novel structured very much like the movie, except it has the first chapter is not a foreword. It's just, well, it is a foreword, but for some reason he did it as a chapter, and the last chapter is an afterwards, but he also did it as a chapter, I guess, to kind of blend the fact that he went through all this. Mm-hmm. So the first chapter is him and his old war friend going back to Dresden to revisit where they were years before.
Ooh. Okay.
And then the last chapter kind of mirrors that. And then it jumps into the story, which basically starts with the words, "Listen, : Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time." And he uses the word listen a lot. It's like, listen, it's like a conversation. And then another thing that he uses that they never touch on in this movie, he uses it, I've got it in my notes somewhere, over 100 times, the phrase, "and so it goes." And it's almost always followed by something horrific, you know, like the killing of a dog or the killing of, you know, massive amounts of people. And it'll just say, "and so it goes." So it's got a flow and a familiarity that's conversational, yet it's got humor and irony and profundity and all that shit in it, too. It's deeply layered. And I can't say enough about how much I love this book and how every American should read this book, especially now.
Yeah, I do think that he had a lot of social conscience and put it in everything. I do think that he also had his own little metaverse, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because like I said, I've only read Breakfast of Champions, but Breakfast of Champions had Kilgore Trout, who is also in Slaughterhouse-Five.
Right. A lot of his characters cross over. Mr. Rosewater in the hospital also has his own novel.
Yeah, the God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater has right. his own mm-hmm. novel. Right. Characters go back and forth in his or at least populate his novel, similar to the way, you know, King has done his whole
Dark Tower
series.
Right. That is a key, for sure. They are very, very similar.
But I think watching this movie, having not read the book, but having read Breakfast of Champions, you can see again that underlying of Vonnegut had such, this kind of goes to your, and so it goes, Vonnegut had such belief in humanity.
The good of humanity.
In the good of humanity, underneath or supporting the fact that it's pretty crappy. And
right.
Really horrible and bad things happen to good people.
And a lot of times he uses humor to try to process it. And that's why the book reads so well. It's captured really well in this movie, but I would say only about 70%.
Okay.
You know, the book will punch you in the gut. And there are a few scenes in this movie that will punch you in the gut too. One last thing about that book. The first sentence of the chapter I said is actually a foreword, mm-hmm. begins, all this happened more or less. And in 2010, it was ranked number 38 on the American Book Reviews list of 100 best first lines of a novel.
I would agree with that. Yeah,
so you've got that on the foreword. And then the second chapter begins, listen, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm not going to gush. We'll go on to scenes, though.
Scenes.
Yeah, I have a scene that jumps out at you, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot. This is a really well.
I mean, you could go really simple and say that the blood looks like paint, just like Dawn of the Dead.
The blood, not the best. No. Yeah, I'm not saying that's a good scene. I'm saying, all the nudity works for me. I'll just say that.
And she is wonderful. We'll get to her. But this is her first movie.
Yeah. Could not believe that when I saw that in the notes, in my notes. I think, definitely the ones I remember the most are the traumatic ones. And maybe that's what he intended. So Billy's eventual death, I remember. I thought the assassination was pretty.
That's near the end of the movie. Yes. Impactful. Yes.
The character that is his friend in the prisoner of war camp.
Derby,
that in the way he's.
That's my numero uno scene.
So that unceremoniously one just, killed is just horrible, but
yes.
So true to that time and for the infraction that he did or whatever. I mean, basically he picked up a little figurine, which reminded him of the one he had at home with his wife.
Well, and what I really love about that scene is that it's juxtaposed with the frivolity of his wife's, like, party or whatever, and she's telling the story, and he's like walking inside, and she's like, what was his name? And he goes, Derby. And it's like that whole juxtaposition of this, you know, ideal 50s life versus seeing a man shot right in front of you. Just love the way Roy Hill did that, because I have a feeling he took scenes out of order. I don't think that it's completely in order as it is in the book. Actually, nothing's in order, obviously. It's all out of order.
I was just about to say.
But what I mean is, you know, there's an order to the chaos in the book. And I think Roy Hill's order was probably done differently. And there are some things that are left out, obviously, for filming reasons or adaptation reasons.
Yeah, mine, I think also I really like the way Roy Hill does the initial hook into World War II of him walking through the credit sequence and then the whole foxhole bit of one guy's the big racist, arrogant jock, wants to kill him, thinks he's a Nazi.
And some guy abandons them and they get in a big fight. It's kind of comical. It's not that comical in the movie. I mean, in the book. But and they end up. Well, getting arrested. They also humiliate Billy by giving him a woman's coat, and he eventually ends up in silver boots.
Yes. Yep.
Which is just terrible. The only other scene I can think of right off is first, I mentioned that Derby's death scene is a gut punch. Mm-hmm. That just kills me. But another scene that to me captures the essence of the book is the scene where Billy's lying in his bed and his son turns around and salutes him in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stop it. I was like, oh, I kind of like had to stop the movie for a second. I was like, that was really, really powerful, because that's the kind of stuff he could hit you with in the book and make you think.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's a lot more commentary in the book on that too. It's not really commentary though.
It's all you think about it. He makes you think about it without overtly saying it. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it's subtle, I guess. Yes. That's the way to put it. Yeah.
It's the subtext of it. Yeah.
Well, and I think the issue the movie has for me is it's hard to, it's like I said, I think the conceit is that Billy Pilgrim is unstuck, but also is aware. He knows his entire timeline. He even says so at the end. That's why he types the thing and says, this is, you know, I know how I'm going to be killed and everything else, blah, blah, blah. But the actor, that Michael Sacks actor, who doesn't, I think, have the subtlety to play that. So you kind of have to say, okay, that's a conceit of the movie, and I just buy it, even though I haven't seen it really portrayed that way. Does that make sense?
Kind of. I liked Michael Sacks, and he got a lot of Best Newcomer awards for this movie. But I could see where there could have been a stronger actor. The thing I had, the most unfortunate thing about this movie is the wigs. I don't think any of the wigs look real in this movie.
Yeah, the makeup
effects. He wears a lot of them.
The makeup effects are really weak all the way through. Bad blood, bad wigs, bad makeup. I think aging him didn't work. They needed like a Dick Smith or somebody else who could really.
You're absolutely right. They needed a really good makeup artist, because the film required a young cast that could be made to look older, because you see them at all different points in their lives. Yes.
Correct. Correct. Totally. So no, that one, I agree with you. I think that didn't work for me. And I liked Michael Sacks as the young Billy. I didn't see any of the maturity as he went through it. All I saw was a guy who just became kind of closed off and wouldn't, and didn't want to have any expression or talk or say or anything, which, the reason that in my, you know, what do they call it in your mindscape, the way you retcon it in your head kind of thing? I think Billy knows everything that's going to happen. That's why he doesn't get overly emotional about it.
Exactly. Because, exactly. You know, yeah.
Which that's the way I kind of retcon it, but that's not the way it really could have been performed with a much stronger actor who's able to play that.
Right. And know he really. He doesn't have any lines, hardly. I was like, is he ever going to talk? And he really doesn't talk until Derby starts talking to him.
Right.
He doesn't really have a conversation. He'll just, you know, apologize or say yes or no or something. You know, it's just very little. The only other thing I can say as far as scenes, and this is not really a scene, but it's on the comic and kind of sad side, but it makes me laugh. And I think you may have to correct me. I'm pretty sure it's Montana that asks him, what did he love best about his wife? And he says, her pancakes.
Her pancakes, yeah.
Yeah, he's good. Like, oh my God.
He's really good at those non sequiturs, those just bizarre lines or use of words or phrases that you just go, what?
Okay. Oh, yeah, sure. It was funny. Funny. So do you want to move on to cast? Did you have any other scenes or anything?
No, cast is
okay. This cast is a great cast, but it's not a very well-known cast. As we mentioned, Michael Sacks plays Billy Pilgrim. This was his debut. However, he was in Sugarland Express. I've never seen that, but it's a Spielberg movie, so I'm assuming you have.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember him in it?
Not really.
Me either. And he's also in Amityville Horror, and I don't remember him in that either.
Again, a very cipher kind of thing for it. Yeah.
Well, I guess maybe he knew that he wasn't very memorable, because he only did 14 movies and then quit. And he had a long and successful career as a technology industry executive with Morgan Stanley, the Salomon Brothers, and IBM afterwards. So he got out of the biz, and that's mm-hmm. what he does now, if he does, if he's not retired. There is another person that could, that was thought of to play this, and I think it would have been the same result. Do you know who? He was in a movie I liked, though, this around the same time, called Carnal Knowledge. Art Garfunkel.
Art Garfunkel?
Was actually offered the role and turned it down.
I think you would have had the same issues.
I think you would have had the same issues, too. He's not a strong actor. The reason Carnal Knowledge is good is because Anne Margaret and Jack Nicholson are in it.
Yeah, basically.
After seeing this film, Art says he regrets turning it down, though. And I could see why, you know.
I'm sure.
Ron Lieberman played Paul Lazzaro. One of these days, I'm going to get you.
You're on my list. You're on my list, Pilgrim.
Yes, he's a psychopath. He is. He is the soup Nazi or whatever. You're on my list. That was the Chinese food delivery in Friends, wasn't it?
It's Lazzaro says it several times, too.
Yes, he does. Yeah. And the reason I bring that up about Friends, though, is because he played Monica's dad on Friends.
Yes.
Yep. And I was like, where have I seen that guy before? He's been a working actor for a very long time. He was also on The Soprano. Ironically enough, both on Friends and The Sopranos, he played a doctor. In this, he's a psychotic nutcase. Mm-hmm. Eugene Roach played Edgar Derby.
Yes.
The sympathetic character. Wonderful, wonderful actor. He has 144 TV credits.
Yeah, great actor.
But as far as movies, he was also in Foul Play and Executive Decision, a little Kurt Russell thriller there that I like.
And he's like the Maytag man, right? Isn't he the Maytag guy? I thought he was.
No. No, the Maytag guy was in something I watched recently, though. I think it may have been Invasion of the Body Snatchers. No, okay. it was an old 50s movie, though. But I know who you're talking about, and that's a different guy. Now, he could have been one of them. There was more than one.
I thought he shilled something.
I'm sure he was in commercials, too.
He was like the Ajax. He was an Ajax spokesperson.
Okay,
well, there you go. Yeah, so there you go.
Sharon Gans played Valencia Merble Pilgrim, the wife that is perpetually promising to lose weight. she only has 3 credits, so she didn't stick to acting either. I'm like, where did Roy Hill find these people that, you know, do one big film and then really don't do that many more?
Then he might have been looking, though, intentionally for newcomers kind of thing.
True.
You know.
So, true.
So there's that.
I mean, because when he did Garp, I mean, Robin Williams was relatively new to movies anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Valerie Perrine plays Montana Wild Hack. I love that name.
Oh, yes, she does.
this is Valerie's debut in this movie, but it is not her debut on our podcast. She was in last year's Superman that we covered. Actually, almost exactly a year ago, because we did Superman in January, too.
Miss Tessmacher?
Yes, Mrs. Tessmacher. This was her first nude scene. However, it works really well. She was a showgirl in Vegas, and when asked to screen test for the role, she arrived with no pictures or headshots. She didn't know that was required of her. But when they found out she was a showgirl, they asked her to wear one of her outfits, a G-string and a skimpy bra. Me too. Watch out. So they could see her figure since the role required nudity. She happily agreed, and after seeing her, they gave her the part. And she is wonderful in it. But I was making jokes about Me Too, and I don't want to offend anybody, but that is what this role is. It is meant for a woman that is probably in softcore porn.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a couple of reviews that called her a Playboy bunny.
Right.
Or a playmate right. or whatever. But yeah, she was obviously doing softcore and they watched it, Kilgore and, I mean, Pilgrim and his family
watched at the drive-in.
See
her in a movie that looks like one of those old Steve Reeves movies set in Egypt and she's like naked in a hot tub. Yeah.
His son is later caught with a magazine with her in it.
Yes.
And the Tralfamadorians bring her to Tralfamador.
To be Billy's mate at the, it's not the end because there is no end.
Are you going to mate now?
Yes. That's funny. Funny stuff. Okay.
But yeah, she was really good in it. What worked was she had to play this kind of ditzy character who also had a heart.
Right.
And I thought Perrine did a really good job of that.
Yeah.
You know.
She's wonderful in it. She never got the acclaim that she could have potentially had, but I thought she was really good in this, and I thought she was really good in the Superman movies as well.
Yeah.
Robert Pilgrim, Billy Pilgrim's son, is also a familiar face. Did you recognize him?
No.
That is Perry King. Television actor that went on to do that show Riptide. You remember that show from the 80s?
Vaguely, yeah.
He was also in the movies The Day After Tomorrow, The Class of 1984. Another person was considered for this role, and you're going to laugh when I tell you this. Dirk Benedict was considered, and I thought Dirk Benedict and Perry King were the same person. They're both like Don Johnson. They're both like television action people.
I could see that. Yeah.
And anyway, so I mean, you could put Dirk Benedict next to Perry King, and like I said, I think they'd be the same person. Kevin Conway played Roland Weary. Weary has a larger part in the book. In this, he's the one with the like gangrene feet that Billy keeps accidentally bumping into and that makes Paul Lazaro so mad.
Mm-hmm.
He dies right away, as does the Wild Bill Cody character, who is in the book a little longer too. Both of their deaths are established by the time they reach the prisoner camp.
Okay.
They get off the train and they're dead. Those two are dead. So that's I guess, a way that Roy Hill was trying to set up, you know, some of the stuff that was going on in the Vonnegut novel as far as senseless death. Frederick von Lederer played the German leader. The only thing I know him from is Moby Dick. I don't know what he played. I guess he was one of Ahab's
crew. Yeah, he did
a
lot of German films, but he was mostly a character actor, background actor.
Right. Yep. Eckhart Bell played a young German guard. He was in Underworld. That was the kid-like guard that ran to his house when it was on fire after the bombing.
Yeah, they had the girlfriend.
Yeah. Sorrel Book played Lionel Marble, his father-in-law. Did you recognize him?
He's fat hog guy. Boss
yes,
hog.
Boss Hog right. from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
He dies in the plane crash
that
Billy survives. Billy's the only survivor of. Yes, folks, there's a plane crash in this movie, too. Robert Blossoms played Wild Bill Cody. I mentioned him. You might have recognized him from Close Encounters. He was in that.
Yeah. He's Close Encounters. He's the farmer that tells him that kind of ruins it for Dreyfus during the interview.
Okay. Yeah. And I remember that. And I guess Sam Raimi liked him because he cast him in The Quick and the Dead as well.
He's got a great face, good as an older actor kind of thing. So, yeah.
John Daner played Professor Rumford, the guy that's in the hospital next to Billy after his brain surgery, that's kind of like an arrogant teacher. Remember, there's a woman in there talking to him. That dude has 302 acting credits.
Oh, yeah. He's been including, in everything.
Yeah, I mean, you would know him from The Right Stuff because I know you like that movie, but he was also in The Boys from Brazil. And then
well, also all these television shows, everything. He always plays either a dad or a father or a scientist or a professor. He's got a great voice. John Daner has a great voice.
Yeah. Richard Shaw played Howard Campbell, the expatriate that turns German, that's lecturing them right before the bombing of Dresden. I only made a note of him because he played Chuckles the Clown on Mary Tyler Moore. And I am a huge Mary Tyler Moore fan. I have all of those DVDs.
Well, that episode is a television
That's a
classic
episode, so, too. Yeah, yeah, that's the one where they're laughing at the funeral. Henry Bumstead, who played Elliot Rosewater, I mentioned him. He is actually an art director and does art direction for most of Roy Hill's films. He also did 4 Hitchcock movies, including Vertigo. Okay. I don't know why he ended up being in this, but he is cast in this. Mm-hmm. Lucille Benson played Billy's mother briefly. She was in 1941, the Spielberg movie, mm-hmm. as well as Duel, the Spielberg movie, as well as Halloween 2. And then lastly, the last familiar face is John Wood, who played the English officer inducting Billy into the new prison camp or acclimating him. You don't remember him?
Vaguely.
Oh, vaguely. He's a very familiar face. He plays a lot of baddies. He was in War Games. He was in Lady Hawk, Sabrina, Chocolat.
John Wood. Okay. I need to look him up then.
John Wood. He's very young in this, but you'll recognize him immediately as soon as you look him up.
All right.
And that's all I have for casting. As far as awards, the Golden Globes nominated this for newcomer Michael Sacks. The Writers Guild nominated this for adapted from another medium because it's an adapted screenplay. And the Directors Guild nominated Roy Hill.
Mm-hmm.
None of those did it win. However, it won a Saturn Award from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror for Best Science Fiction Film of 1973, I guess it would be, because it came out in 72. Mm-hmm. It won a Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. It won the Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festivals. And it is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list.
I would agree, probably. Yeah.
I kind of disagree. But I realize that that list cannot be composed of just science fiction and horror movies.
Agreed.
So you can't put every sci-fi out there, but I like this. This is one of those movies with a strong message, and I think that would warrant placement there. So that's my opinion. Okay, I'm going to throw it to you. Where are we going next? Trivia keys?
Right before keys, I've just got some trivia stuff. Yeah, sure. And some of it you've already mentioned. One of the things we did mention, though, was this is pseudo-autobiographical.
Yes.
Because Kurt Vonnegut did survive Dresden.
Right.
And that's horrible. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people died, a lot of them civilians.
He says hundreds of thousands. I think they correct that because I've got a note somewhere where someone said it wasn't that many. And he says, does it matter?
Yeah, I think it's 28,000 I saw.
Right. But his point, I mean, this is pure Vonnegut. You know, when he gets corrected on the numbers of deaths, he's like, really? Does it matter?
So. I've got in just trivia notes, the matte paintings in this were done by Albert Whitlock, who we've mentioned before. Did The Thing, Star Wars, a bunch of great stuff. Roy Hill and Monash, who was the producer, originally wanted to do all of the, quote, flashback scenes in black and white. So they wanted all the contemporary 50s to be in color, but all the war stuff to be in black and white. But when they started looking at it structurally, they thought it would be too jarring for people.
I think that would have taken away from it. I think it should be consistent because that's what the absurdity of the novel is.
Agreed. And that's what the whole precept of him is, that time is fluid. He's in all of these times at the same time. So he wouldn't ever have a memory or a flashback. Everything is omnipresent.
And you wouldn't want to distinguish anything from anything else because it's all one line, basically, just out of order.
And I basically say, in my notes, I say, I don't really have a favorite scene in this because none of the scenes are really long enough. Every scene almost cuts at its climax, which is kind of interesting. And you think about it, and I go back and go, yeah, right when I'm getting interested in that freaking Mr. Rosewater guy, we cut and we never come back to him.
I've got a key to that, too. We'll get to that. That's funny. Trivia, though. I mentioned he says, and so it goes. It appears over 100 times in the novel, though it's not uttered once in the movie. And it always was following the events of death, dying, mortality. And used as a narrative transition to another topic. So he would like say something really horrible, and so it goes, and then just move on to the next thing. I mean, it sounds funny, but it's really not. It was just like his way of processing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There's what I said about Vonnegut's claim of a death of 135 was corrected to 25, and he says, does it matter? Michael Sacks, who plays Billy Pilgrim, is 11 months older than his on-screen daughter, played by Holly Knear, and only 4 months younger than Perry King, who plays his son. But that really makes sense because it's told in different times of their lives. They all have to be aged.
Yes.
I also mentioned briefly earlier mental illness. Some have argued that Vonnegut is speaking out for veterans and what they went through afterwards, because post-traumatic stress disorder didn't exist back then. They didn't have that terminology. And that it could be recognized as a mental disorder, because there is a scene in this where he gets electric shock therapy.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, if you're a pragmatist or whatever and don't, like, read a lot of science fiction, you could interpret this movie to him just being wacko and this all being in his head. Like his children do.
You could, but that is really not elevated at all.
It shouldn't be, because that's not what Vonnegut wanted. And then lastly, I've got a quote where Kurt Vonnegut later wrote, I love George Roy Hill and Universal Pictures, who made a flawless translation of my novel. So I thought that was very sweet.
I've got, and it's a quote, so I'm not sure if it's from the novel or if it's from something else, but it says, the world is a collection of moments. I may have seen that in a review, or I may have seen it in a Vonnegut quote or whatever, because it's right before a big quote I have of Vonnegut's, which I'll just read it because it's really quick, which says, Vonnegut recounts a meeting with film producer Harrison Starr at a party, who asked him whether his forthcoming book was another anti-war novel. Yes, I guess, replied Vonnegut. Starr responded, why don't you write an anti-glacier novel? In the novel, Vonnegut's character continues, what he meant, of course, is that there would always be wars.
Right.
That they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. And that was a Vonnegut quote. And I thought that was great. And then my last trivia I have is this was a major flop, really, probably because it was released the day after The Godfather.
Oh, my gosh. No wonder.
So that could have contributed a lot, I think, to its lack of financial success. So
yeah.
Keys?
First of all, you said Kurt Vonnegut earlier. I say Kurt Vonnegut is the biggest key in this movie, because you, like you said, he was in the city of Dresden when it was bombed, and that horrendousness was covered up for quite some time because there was some controversy, because Dresden was not like a city to be targeted. It was not, you know, they were not manufacturing weapons there. They were not, you know, it was pretty much a harmless city, and it got bomb. That's where the POW camps were.
Well, it was their biggest city. That's why.
Right. Of course, Vonnegut came home traumatized and unable to properly communicate the horror that he experienced there. And it took him 20 years to write this book and find a way that to process it that satisfied him. And so, I mean, he was always saying, I'm working on my war book. I'm working on my war book. And then, of course, it comes out, and it's his bestseller, his first bestseller. So,
yes.
Other keys?
My biggest key is The Arrival. Because again, it deals in nonlinear time. And that's the big twist at the end of Arrival, right. Whereas it's the start of this one. But again, I don't think we really achieve it as well as we probably do, as it probably does in the novel, in the movie, but I do think it's a huge key, in the time travel thing. And I've got a lot of the time travel ones coming up, but the other one I have that this movie reminds me of is Catch 22.
I can see that.
It's very similar in the fact that war is absurd and the absurdity of war in places, almost like MASH, too, could be another key.
MASH was a key for me, for sure.
So, you know, that whole, like when the British guards come out and start, I mean, the British prisoners come out and they're singing and doing the whole kind of Gilbert and Sullivan's kind of
song. I mean, they might as well have been in drag. It's so out of place. Yeah.
It was very absurd looking, but very British, and very in keeping, showing the culture of the Russians, the British, and the American prisoners, and how they're all three different. You know, the Russians were behind the barbed wire fence and kept at bay. The British were kind of treated okay. I mean, the British were treated great, and the Americans are kind of like, you know, welcome to the war, boys, kind of thing. It was very another key I have was Bridge on the River Kwai. It had that kind of feel to it.
I could see that as well, the whole Alec Guinness thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. British officer. So this is the way we do things, lad. You know.
Did you happen to look up that John Wood guy?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you recognize him now?
Oh, yeah.
And he's the one that was talking to Billy when Billy was trying to eat. And every time he tried to say something, Billy would have to stop. And then finally he just falls face first into his soup.
Yep.
Yeah. And then he meets Roger Derby or whatever Derby's first name is. All right. Other keys. Sorry. I digress as usual. The novel, obviously, is a big key. One of the things I could not get out of my head, and this is going to sound ridiculous, when I was watching all this stuff was Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because it is, you know, it's not a concentration camp with, you know, Jews being exterminated. It's a little more lighthearted with American and British prisoners. So yeah. It reminded me of Hogan's Heroes, the comedy from the 60s. The shock therapy scene is right out of Cuckoo's Nest. I mean, just right out of it, except it came first because Cuckoo's Nest was a couple of years later.
Yep.
And then you mentioned the jarring transitions, how it wasn't necessarily jarring, but it would get to a climatic point and then switch to a different place in time.
Yes.
Yep. I put the book It, the way Stephen King transitions from chapters to the present to the past, present to the past.
I think that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nonlinear. I mean, nonlinear anything really falls into a key for this.
Well, I've got a few. So I've got The Cage, Gene Roddenberry, because, you know, intergalactic zoo sort of story. That's also a big, you know, Lost in Space trope at the time, too. So that one. I've got Billy's mama. The scene with her is when he's all covered up in the blanket. I think it's also the scene with Rosewater, isn't it? But his mom is the one that's talking about, that's my little baby boy and blah, 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 and bragging on him and everything. Just the way she looked, the way she did it. And I don't know if this is true or not, but reminded me of The Wall, the way they do the mother, Billy's, you know, mother in that.
You stole my key.
Okay. Did you have that key?
I didn't have it from the mother, but I had it from when they're walking through Dresden and all the citizens are like hanging out the windows, watching them and pointing and stuff. That reminded me of The Wall, Alan Parker's film of the Pink Floyd novel. That whole
bring the boys back home kind of.
Yes, exactly. Sequence. So I had it for different reasons, but that's so funny that we both went to that film.
Yeah. Well, but it's again, I think it's the way it's shot and the way they shot The Wall.
And she's overbearing.
Yeah, and the way it's done with that pseudo-British sort of thing to it, I guess, mystique to it.
Mm-hmm.
Mise-en-scene. Yeah. I've got Lazaro's List. He mentions it several times. It reminded me of Arya's List in Game of Thrones. She's the same way as she lives through her life and meets people that upset her or make her or, you know, wrong her. She adds them to a list that she is going to kill before she dies. sort of thing. And that's well, kind of
Paul Lazaro was serious, obviously, because you get the impression that he's all talk, because sometimes he gets kind of put in his place in the war camp. But sure enough, he does show up at the end of this movie and shoots Billy Pilgrim.
And we have to say, you know, you can't do a time travel story without time travel other stories that are influenced by it or influenced from it. So even down to, you know, we just this season we've done a couple of time travel already. So
I know. That's wild.
But you've
got, I didn't intend that.
You know, Looper, we did Looper a couple of years ago. Right. That was definitely one that has deals with time in such a kind of unique way, different way than just, oh, get in a machine and go. Somewhere in Time, of course, has no machine. It's all mental. There's another one. There's a series that only lasted a season. It's called The Time Traveler's Wife. It's about a guy who is unstuck in time. So it is definitely influenced by Slaughterhouse-Five. However, he knows when it's happening. He starts getting all flushed. He gets almost like he's having a heart attack kind of thing. And then suddenly he finds himself in a different time. And he never has clothes. That's the gag and the thing is it's worse than the Hulk. He is totally nude when he appears in the new time frame. And he goes back and forth throughout his life, even meeting his previous selves. Sort of thing. It's kind of a unique story, but they never finished it, so it's not really worth investing time in it since it's not got an ending.
You mentioned ties to, or maybe it was me, mentioned ties to other books via characters, namely Elliot Rosewater in the title character from the 1965 novel, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater.
Yeah.
There is a movie tie that is similar in this. And I have not seen this movie. I took this from IMDb. The character of Howard Campbell Jr. appears in the film and speaks to the American POWs before the bombing of Dresden. Vonnegut wrote an entire novel about this character called Mother Night, which was made into a movie starring Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte's it. Yeah.
I've not seen it, though. Have you?
I'm not, but I've heard of it because it's an anti-war movie.
I'm so sure. Came up all of Vonnegut's stuff's anti-war. Or not all of it, but anything to do with the war would be anti. But yeah.
Yeah. I've also got Confederacy of Dunces. Confederacy of Dunces has a, you know, literary work, hasn't ever been made into a film, as far as I know. But the unique thing I remember from it is this, the way it does the absurdity and the comedy and the way everybody has unique names in it. And Kurt Vonnegut always has unique names.
They almost describe the character.
Almost, yeah. There's a little bit of that in there. Mr. Rosewater, Elliot Rosewater.
Pilgrim. And, you know, he's like Billy a pilgrim in everything he's going through. And Montana Wild Hack sounds like a porno actress. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of thought that goes into his character naming sort of thing.
And Kilgore Trout is the fictional novelist version of himself, and he's a total jerk. He makes appearances in other books as well. He makes an appearance in this book, but not the movie.
Well, and he's in Breakfast. He's Breakfast Champion.
Right.
That's his.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I didn't have other keys, but I have a question for you, and you may have already answered it a little bit.
Well, let me do one last key before you do your question. The last key I have is the whole entire series of Doctor Who.
Okay.
Because it deals with a Time Lord. And there's even a David Tennant episode where he's trying to explain what Time Lords are and what they are and yada, yada. But he says that Time Lords see all time always. So they see throughout time in every level all the time. That's what creates, I mean, that's what one of the abilities of a Time Lord. So that's essentially what, so Billy Lord is a, you know, Billy Pilgrim is a Time Lord.
Kind of. I mean, he can't control it though.
Correct. He doesn't have a TARDIS. So it just happens.
Yeah, and there's one scene in this movie that bothers me, and it's when he's lying in bed with the dog at night and the Trafamadorians come down and that, like, why did that happen? I mean, he had already encountered them outside with the dog earlier in the novel. which establishes that he's been captured. Why would he be on Earth again and then come back again? That didn't make sense because to me.
Well, to me, it kind of added to that whole mystique of it's all happening at the same time anyway. Hmm. So it really doesn't – it's not sequential. So it doesn't matter. One of those visits, he wasn't captured,
I guess. Correct. Maybe one was an observation visit.
One or the other was a capture.
Yeah. So okay. That makes sense. That does make sense to me now. And then lastly, I had a question for you that you kind of answered earlier, but there's a lot of sci-fi out there with where people are captured and kept in like a zoo.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't think – the only one I could think of was wasn't there like a sequel to The Thing where they were actually going around and capturing specimens from different planets or something?
Sequel to Alien? Thing?
Maybe it's – no, it's not Alien. I want to say it was The Thing. I think I read a story once in like a –
could have been.
It was probably in a Thing anthology of just different stories about it or something where that was a creature that they kept – that they went and they shouldn't have gone to get because it was too out of control.
The only real episode of Lost in Space I can tolerate is the two-parter called The Keeper where Michael Rennie plays a curator of an intergalactic zoo. And it's the same thing. You know, the original pilot for Star Trek is an intergalactic zoo.
Okay, that's the other one that I'm probably thinking
the
of.
The Talosians capture them. And yeah, it's a tenant. You know, well, even, it's not humans, but, you know, in E.T., the reason they're on Earth is they're collecting specimens of all the plants because they're botanists. So, yeah, this whole kind of – there are collectors out there that have visited Earth and taken people. Could have easily been a big sci-fi trope.
It's a trope, for sure. Yeah. Human zoos or whatever. I mean, even Planet of the Apes, they have a museum with humans in it.
Well, yeah. We have museums with monkeys in it. So yeah. There you go.
That's true. That's true.
So, as they should.
All right. Well, I believe that's going to wind us up if you don't have any other keys. I think that David enjoyed this movie. I certainly did.
Yes.
Any George Roy Hill movie. Oh, another key I had, sorry, was Garp. I mean, Garp is about a very unique individual, and it follows him through his entire life. And this movie does the same. Follows Billy Pilgrim through his entire life. So it's a story about one man. And I had forgotten to mention that, but that's also a George Roy Hill film.
Yes.
I think this film is exquisitely shot. Like you said, cinematography is beautiful, and I would highly recommend it. I would go one step further to even recommend the book even more. Folks out there, if you've not read this book, you need to pick it up because it is classic American literature from the 20th century.
Yes, I would agree. Even though I haven't, so I fall into that category.
He'll be reading it soon because I will send it to him on audio, his new drug.
I will, yes.
And if you like what you hear, we'd love for you to give us a review, a shout out, comment. If you're watching us on YouTube, please subscribe down there.
Please.
We have other shows on YouTube as well, including Coming to Get You, Coming Attractions, and Top Fives we do occasionally. Have another one of those coming out soon. And we've got some stuff over on Patreon as well. If you want to be more of a supporter of the show, we have some subscription-based content over there, including shows on Star Trek and the X-Files. We also have bonus episodes that are not subscription content. So if you just want to go because you're curious, please do. And until next week, David, when I'm assuming we'll be back in Horrorland, are we?
We will.
Okay. I will take your word for it. I'll see you then.
Oh, yeah. You'll like it.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.